I'm Darren.
And I'm Mindy, and we are the Rance Macabre, now part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and to find past episodes of the Rance Macabre, please visit fangoria.com.
In the late 30s, Hammer Productions was founded by William Hines, a comedian. His stage name was Will Hammer, probably taken from his neighborhood, Hammersmith, home of the Hammersmith Apollo. While probably not the greatest businessman, Hammer Productions did manage to make four movies before having to declare bankruptcy, the first time. Scraping by during war times and periods of Reconstruction, they committed to genre films, making science fiction, film noir, thrillers, and comedies, though it wasn't until they began their run of trademark gothic Hammer horror that they really began to see a return on their investments. The way Malcolm Gladwell talks about outliers capitalizing on the right variables lining up during a perfect moment in time, Hammer Film Productions took advantage of the new X rating and the opportunity to show previously unseen levels of gore portrayed in vivid color. Enter Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, coincidentally born a day apart in 1922. The English actors appeared in two of the same films before working for Hammer, but it wasn't until The Curse of Frankenstein in 1957 that they worked together. Under the direction of Terence Fisher, Cushing and Lee built the foundation of Hammer horror. Together, they were a modern Lugosi and Karloff, or Karloff and Lon Chaney Jr., or whichever combination is your favorite. I know you really dig Lugosi, and I like Karloff a lot, but I've watched these movies, and I'm firmly in the Cushing-Lee-Hammer camp. I could watch Cushing read the phone book.
I would like to have seen like a Cushing Lugosi Karloff sitch.
Yeah, it'd be like a challenge of who could chew the most scenery.
Definitely. Everyone would overpronounce everything, and every like direction would be very direct. Every line has like a very explicit purpose.
Yeah, and they'd like compete to stare down the camera itself.
Exactly. It's like who can spend the longest thinking.
So Hammer dominated the horror film market in the 60s and early 70s, but sadly it didn't last. The formula that brought them success was never really adapted for the changing times. If anything, they doubled down on the gore and the sexuality. So when the trends in horror moved towards the more cerebral stories like Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist, they were left behind. That said, for this episode, we're going to glory in the best of their monster works. Well, I'm going to celebrate. Mindy is going to bear with me.
It's not that. Yeah, we'll get into it.
I was a little bummed that you weren't digging these as much as I was
really bummed out, too, because my father is a huge Hammer horror fan. And so I thought, like, I'm a huge horror fan. And there's like a preconceived notion that there's certain things you have to like if you're a horror fan. And I was like, is there something wrong with me? Because
right, what am I missing?
Yeah, it's just not, I guess, for me. I mean, I think Peter Cushing is amazing, and I think he's a very, very good actor. Christopher Lee, I could take or leave. And I remember, like, people, when they talk about Christopher Lee, like, he's so cool. He's the coolest, sexiest Dracula. And to me, like, I'll take Bela any day, you know?
Yeah.
He's, like, to me, Bela's, like, the sexiest Dracula.
It's interesting that sort of cutoff, considering like these are all retro movies.
Right.
And they both still sort of play on a theatrical in the theater sense, where these actors are, you know, this isn't exactly like true to life. This isn't exactly honest behavior in terms of like acting. So it's funny that like you go in for the Lugosi and the Karloff, not so much for this, like, you know, newer take on these stories.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know. I think there is very much a idea of this being marketed, these movies really marketed towards men.
Okay.
Kind of like don't really care what, you know, I feel like in the Universal, it's for everybody.
Mm.
It was for everybody. And I feel like Hammer Films is really for men. It's a boys' club.
Well, yeah, and the Universal was kind of, I mean, it was prude on account of the era,
right,
whereas these were scandalous because of the women.
Right.
Yeah,
and it's all about
the gore,
like,
also caters to the
yeah.
The men.
I mean, you do have some people, you know, like Michael Goh and Peter Cushing, you know, who, you know, play kind of like a handsome kind of gentleman, but it's not really aimed for
No.
For like the ladies to experience it. And to me, when people talk about Hammer films, they talk about the sexuality of the films.
Yeah.
That's a big selling point. And so then on my point of view, that's not selling it for me because it doesn't work in that way for me. So I just want to see the story. And
you didn't think it was sexy when Christopher Lee is sort of sniffing out the face.
That scene, there's a scene in The Horror of Dracula where Mina is now like under Dracula's thrall, and she's in the bed, and Dracula
appears in the doorway and sort of comes in.
And you think like, oh, they're gonna maybe make out. She looks at him and she's kind of got a look like, maybe. And he looks at her and he's kind of like, did I lock my doors? And then they look at each other some more. And so then,
did I leave the stove on?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe. What's that smell? Is kind of the idea. And then you think maybe they're going to make out or he's going to bite her. But instead, he kind of like holds her face and like sniffs all over it. Like he kind of just like rubs his face like a cat.
It's animalistic in that way. I guess her initial reaction is like, he's an unknown quantity.
Sure.
All she knows is she is in. Sort of, she is hypnotized.
Yes, she's hypnotized.
And then he follows that up with sort of sniffing her out, like
literally
stray
sniffing
animals.
Her face.
Yeah.
and then I think, and they wanted to cut that originally. Censors wanted that particular part cut. And
telling,
it's just like,
because they thought it was too erotic.
Yeah, that was too sexy. When a man sniffs a lady's face, babies happen.
So that's jumping ahead a little bit, and we'll bounce around, but we are going to keep, for the most part, in chronological order. Mm-hmm. One of the things I guess I was concerned about going into these, because I had started watching The Curse of Frankenstein, and then I stopped, and I didn't finish watching it until we started doing research for this, and I wasn't immediately grabbed, mm-hmm. and I felt a lot of this episode that we're doing was going to be sort of homework feeling.
Right. I watched it in two parts as well.
When I wasn't initially grabbed, I started thinking in terms of, well, at least I'll get out of it knowing the influences of the guys I like.
Right.
And so on that note, I thought of it in terms of like when I was a teenager becoming obsessive over music, it was one of my favorite things to do was dig into a band and sort of explore music through their filter. And the idea of like, you know, who influenced this band and who influenced that band mm-hmm. and on and on and on. And so I thought this series of movies was going to be that, but I was pleasantly surprised that I like most of them.
That's how I felt about Universal.
Yeah.
You know, and not so much in this case, but, you know.
When we were actually just at work today doing our writing and looking stuff up, you showed me a clip of John Carpenter talking about mm-hmm. his first experience with Hammer horror.
The Hammer film, Curse of Frankenstein. That was mind-blowing to me. Because that was one of the first horror films that took a subject, the Frankenstein idea, and brought in, for a time, of shocking violence, shocking gore, shocking things.
And your dad talked about the same idea that, like, now in Technicolor were these monsters,
right.
And blood looked like blood.
And they would even paint certain aspects of the scene to be red. So they were painting leaves in occasional scenes that you could really get that really vivid red.
Yeah. So let's start with Frankenstein.
All right. This is an excerpt from The Changing Vampire of Film and Television. Hammer took an extreme risk when it devoted everything to the production of The Curse of Frankenstein. The studio knew that in order to survive, it had to shake off their B-feature reputation. They took the bold step, completely changing their output, shelving 10 films already slated for production. The last piece of the puzzle was the return of color to film. Sir James Carreras, then the head of Hammer, realized there had never been a Frankenstein or Dracula in color. With vivid Technicolor, Hammer's take on Dracula was strikingly different from its Universal progenitor.
Starting with The Curse of Frankenstein mm-hmm. in 1957, I thought it was interesting. I was looking for a cultural marker, and it turned out 1957 is when Leave It to Beaver first hit the television.
Perfect. Great American Family.
Leave It to Beaver in black and white was this like wholesome. It was supposed to be like the best of suburban middle class
right.
America, and across an ocean, they're getting excited about the idea of scaring the pants off people.
Right.
Well, what do you think of it?
It's horrible. Paul, the features are not important. What matters is I'm creating a being that will live and breathe.
Directed by Terrence Fisher, who would go on to direct a bunch of other Hammer horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
Terrence Fisher made more monster movies than James Whale and Todd Browning put together.
Oh, wow.
They were the Universal mainstays who created the Dracula and Frankenstein franchises. He himself went from directing films to directing television and then back to film. And you can kind of read that, especially in The Curse of Frankenstein, because their set pieces almost look like a sitcom.
Yeah.
They're kind of lit in an average way where you could move throughout the scene and be in good lighting. And the camera doesn't move a ton.
To me, when I see it, it really reminds me of watching a play.
Yeah.
Because you could have a camera just set out and you could capture the entire set and you could capture the entire scene. Yeah,
you get a couple like zoom ins and a little bit of like panning with the characters, but for the most part, like it looks like an episode of I Love Lucy.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And you hear it in the audio too. You can hear him kind of walking around in a hollow kind of environment. The sound is not so great.
It's like a soap opera where they're clicking like shoes on the beach.
As I was watching this, you know, I was, you know, I'm always trying to push Dark Shadows on you. And I was watching this, I was like, you know what was better? Dark Shadows.
Oh, that's funny.
Because the set is very, it's very similar gothic, again, style horror.
Okay.
And then, yeah, you can hear like the other sounds going around the studio. You can hear like echo and hollowness.
Yeah. I got the feeling that most of the movies eventually opened up substantially. Yeah. But at the time, especially in Frankenstein's laboratory, there's bubbling things everywhere. And so that kind of fills in the room noise and the ambiance, but it's all happening on the spot.
And part of me though was just like, put some carpet down and that will solve this problem right now.
No, Frankenstein's getting way too sticky with experiments. You don't want, that's like having a carpeted kitchen.
Well, I know, it'd be like a stain immediately. Blood and gore staining your carpet.
So it's worth mentioning that pretty early on in this process, when Universal got wind that Hammer was going to be doing the classic monsters, they threatened to sue the shit out of them and told them, you can't even use the original source material because they were pretty closely adapted for the Universal movies. Mm-hmm. And so now Hammer's in the spot of like, all right, well, we got to rewrite classic horror monster stories.
Good
luck. That said, they made gold.
Well, what was really great, I thought about, you know, what I did like about it was the retelling of the story.
The different angle?
Yeah, because you go in and you know the story of Frankenstein, you know Dracula. And so then to see it change is kind of, it was nice. And I bet in this, like in the late 50s when this happened, like everyone knew what to expect from it.
Right.
And so you go into the theater and you're like, what? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think seeing Frankenstein instead of, you know, like you feel kind of sorry for him in the Universal and this one, you don't, he's such an, like a pompous shit in this movie.
Yeah. And a womanizer to boot.
They
play a couple different things. In the original, he was work obsessed. He was sort of, you know, there are a couple scenes where his wife is just like, oh, I wish my husband wasn't so busy. I wish he could tend to me. And he's just like, bitch, I got work to do.
Yeah, exactly. I'm creating people here.
So in response to the Universal pressure, Hammer had Jimmy Sangster completely redo the script and had Jack Asher shoot in Eastman color, which was the sort of precursor to Technicolor.
Mm-hmm.
The script was revised several times to avoid any repeating elements from the original stories. And I think even just in terms of like popular culture, that moment where Frankenstein goes, it's alive,
right?
They changed the reveal really effectively and it sits firmly in the horror genre as a result. So where the original was sort of going for sci-fi of the day, this was like, no.
Right.
you're going to be afraid.
Yeah, from this the is what you're going to get if you put some dead body parts together. It's going to look like this.
Yeah, a 6'4" monster waiting for you when you open that door.
And that to me is like, no wonder he's kind of fucked up. You've let him be in the room. This is very similar to Universal.
Yeah.
It's like, well, he's been alive for a while and he's covered up. His eyes are covered up. What's he thinking right now?
It's like Christopher Lee with a sense for the theatric waits to unbandage. He stood up.
He's just standing and waiting.
He's facing the door.
Maybe
his ears are
good.
He's like
a dog. You know, he's just like a very like patient dog that just waits for you to come in the house at night.
Yeah. So when he does his big, you know, it's like a bandage striptease. When he takes the bandages off to say hello, that's the moment where like this is the first glimpse of Frankenstein. And it's gritty. It is way different than the Karloff bolts in the neck, flat top.
Right.
He looks mangled.
Yeah, it's nice. It's a really good monster.
It is. Although it's funny, we've seen close-ups and like the effects are a little shoddy. And from what I understand, they sort of had to put it together pretty quick. Mm-hmm. And they obviously couldn't use anything the likeness of Universal.
Right, right.
He looks cut up. He's got some pretty gross broad stitch work on his forehead.
Exactly. He's got a Beatles haircut.
It's like Frankenstein's too busy to do like good needlework at this point. Like that's where he's gonna cut corners.
And that's
really
the thing. Yeah, he's so meticulous about every single thing except for the smashed brain that you'd think like his stitch work would be top notch. He should be like a surgeon. But instead, it's like I did the stitches.
Yeah.
Like this'll do.
On Normandy. Like, exactly. Just this has to get close.
Exactly. I'll close this up. Fine.
Super glue it later.
Glue would have been better. The thing that I noticed most of all was like how big Frankenstein's feet were. Like he's wearing shoes and then the wrapping is over the shoes. Did you notice that?
I didn't, no.
And so his feet are really, really big. And all I could think was, damn, monster, you got some big feet.
That's funny. Yeah, no, I didn't notice that. But it's funny that part of like the original Universal Monster, when people dress up, they've got like big Herman Munster shoes. But in this case, it was just Christopher Lee was a big motherfucker.
Yeah, they're just like pointy-toed feet wrappings.
Oh, that's funny. Just the idea that he's got wingtips underneath the gauze. One of the through lines through the movie is the relationship between Victor Frankenstein and Paul Frimke. They go from mentor student to equals, and eventually Frankenstein has the balls to sort of go above and beyond moral, cultural mores, we'll say.
Victor, I appeal to you. Stop what you're doing before it's too late.
But what am I doing? I'm harming nobody. Just robbing a few graves. Then what doctor or scientist doesn't? How else are we to learn the complexities of the human animal?
Doctors rob for the eventual good of mankind. This can never end in anything but evil.
I thought, and maybe I'm reading into it a little bit, but when it becomes a matter of not jealousy, Frankenstein always kind of holds it against him that Paul kind of abandoned him. Mm-hmm. And there's even an element where he's kind of showing off, like I did all this without you, like almost like a spited lover. Like, look how good I'm doing.
Yeah, you had read like something between the two of them, and I didn't feel that way.
You wanted to see me.
Well, it's been a long time since you've been out here, Paul. Now, why is that? You know you're always welcome.
I told you I would not help you.
Haven't you found it difficult keeping away? Just guessing what I was doing? Never knowing just how well I was getting on? Hmm? Well, I decided to let you see my progress. Then you can judge for yourself whether I shall succeed or not. I'm the last state but one. Come and see.
But I could see that, definitely. But the thing about Frankenstein the whole time is that he thinks he's so superior throughout the entire show. Yeah. Like, even when he's a little kid in the very beginning. You know, when they do the flashback, you just want to slap that smug look off his face. And the kid, though, I will say, that kid does a great Peter Cushing impression.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, so this story begins when he's a kid and he's orphaned, but you wouldn't know it because he seems very self-sufficient.
Yeah.
And he's like in charge of the family's finances at 16. And he's hired himself a tutor, like a mentor.
But only to learn what he wants.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And it's funny, but his air of exceptionalism, his sort of, I'll say, air of superiority, it starts then and it also like goes beyond like, he's got a maid. He's going to sleep with the maid. He's going to start an affair there.
Right.
His bride-to-be shows up. They haven't seen each other in years. He's not going to call things off with the maid.
No,
he's Frankenstein.
Why would you? Right.
Yeah, he's not going to.
Plus, she wears those low-cut tops.
Yeah. The cleavage is conspicuous.
It's a lot of cleavage for just walking around the house. I'm really confused on, like, you know, not like everyone has to wear turtlenecks, but like,
it's
come on.
It's almost like Frankenstein might have established a dress code in the house.
I could see him doing that, actually. Right. Because he's sleeping with her, but he still makes her call him by his title. And then she's like, okay.
Yeah, and he bosses around to the extent where he's like,
it's like a 50 Shades kind of thing.
Now that my...
Maybe,
yeah,
maybe.
I could see that. I mean, he is a control freak, so absolutely.
Maybe we're onto something here.
Dr. Frankenstein is a gray whoever from 50 Shades.
Yeah, I don't know. I never read the book.
He is assembling human beings. I mean, there's some BDSM subplot
probably
to be found,
bondage,
I'm sure.
And all the wrapping up of
there
Christopher Lee.
But he chains him to the wall eventually.
Exactly.
There you go. This is fucking weird.
That was a tangent.
In the original movies, he seemed, once he's got the idea in mind, he hits the gas pretty fast and assembles this body. Mm-hmm. And he sends out Igor to find the brain.
Sure.
And he does that in this one, but he's very slow assembling this body. And it's important that he got the body from like a thief who was hung. His eyes were missing, so he was going to need to acquire eyes separately. A pianist dies and he gets his hands.
Right.
And when it comes to whose brain it's going to be, that is a horror dynamic that I thought worked really well.
It worked well in the fact that it got smashed and he wouldn't do anything else but use that brain, even though he knew it was really fucked up.
Oh, I was thinking even before that, the idea that he he entraps this professor.
Right.
Who, I don't remember if they specified what he's...
The stunt work.
So this older guy is brought to dinner, and he, you know, it seems like Frankenstein probably doesn't have a lot of guests. First moment, you should be suspicious. It'd be like, this guy's a shut-in. Why is he inviting me to dinner?
Yeah.
Getting me drunk.
Something's up here.
So once this professor, you know, it's time to call it a night. He's gonna keep him in the castle for the evening, and then brings him to the second floor balcony
to look at a tiny painting.
A tiny painting. And he goes, oh, you'll see it better if you stand farther back. Which, when has that ever been the case?
Yeah,
if you're farsighted, maybe.
Or if you're looking at Impressionist works.
Fair point.
Okay.
This was not an Impressionist painting.
No, this was like a Bosch or something. It had nothing, like, there's no reason to be away from it.
Best scene, perhaps, from the first floor. So I'll help you get there by pushing you over the balcony, breaking his own...
But he makes this incredible, like, ruse out of the whole thing.
If you step back a little, you'll sit there. Look out!
Maybe just in case the guy survives, he's like, you completely misread the situation. I was afraid for your safety.
So I turned you around and I pushed you off the balcony. Because it's not enough to let him fall over backwards on the balcony.
Oh, when,
he has
when
to
he
like give him a
down,
face first view.
If anything, the clip is probably, you could probably find the clip on YouTube, but the stunt or special effect, I don't know. It's that good where this actor goes over the second floor balcony head first onto the stone
like
floor.
Like right on his head. Because we watched it over again because I said, no, he fell on his neck. And you said, no, he fell right on the top of
his
head.
He's got his chin tucked in. It looks like he forehead first.
It's not a good
considering
look.
Frankenstein's whole goal was to retrieve this man's brain.
Why would you offer a head injury? And I'm kind of assuming the head injury is actually what kills him.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, he's got to crack his skull and his neck. Why didn't just, he's a sight. Ether overnight. You just
or just take a needle full of air or something. What?
Yeah.
Done.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Or even, I mean, I don't know, maybe science wasn't that advanced, but like keep them alive until the moment of surgery.
That's pretty cruel. That's you're thinking like a Frankenstein now.
I'm a pragmatist if nothing else. But so he wrecks this dude's head, and then when he reveals to Paul Krempe that I've got a brain.
Yes.
It's the greatest brain of our time that was available. Paul Krempe sort of struggles with them. I won't let you do this.
Right.
And he smashes the brain against the wall.
Well,
and
listen,
it's like
this is like,
sack.
Yeah, this is now two times his brain has sustained pretty severe injury.
But there's more to come.
Yay.
So now with this smashed brain,
yeah,
he's
double
just
a
like,
smash, double smash.
If something goes wrong and this is entirely your fault.
Don't you see? I've succeeded.
Succeeded, yes. Nearly succeeded in getting yourself killed. Another 10 seconds
this
and you would have
This is my creation.
Yes, a criminal lunatic. He tried to kill you.
That's the brain. When you attacked me, it was damaged. That makes it your fault, Paul. Your fault that it's not what I intended it to be. But I can repair the brain. It's what I've done that counts.
Cut your losses. Go get a new brain. You're willing to murder people. Just find another person.
Yeah, at this rate, yeah. Your average brain is going to be better than your professor's
than
brain
the scrambled
smashed twice.
Egg brain. Yes.
This thing must be destroyed before it regains consciousness.
Christopher Lee in this Frankenstein, well, I guess even in the original, Karloff doesn't have speaking lines until the second one.
Right. Well, yeah, he learns how to talk.
Christopher Lee doesn't speak in this one at all. And it's funny, if it's true, there was a joke that they shared behind the scenes where Christopher Lee storms into the dressing room. Him and Cushing are familiar, but they're becoming friends. Christopher Lee is complaining, I don't have any lines in this thing. And Peter Cushing goes, you're lucky because I've read the script. Okay, so not giving all the spoilers away, the monster is loose. And that's the moment where, you know, he's afraid for the townspeople.
Right, it's like,
Frankenstein's monster is already proven to be a little violent.
You promised to destroy it, Victor.
Well, I've carried out my research.
But don't you see you've created a monster?
At that point, Dr. Frankenstein blames Paul for everything that went wrong.
Well, yeah, he's a guy who really can't take responsibility for his own actions.
That doesn't matter. I shall operate on the brain tomorrow. It shouldn't take long.
No, he'll take the credit, but not...
Oh, yeah, he's like got the superior idea, but then when something goes wrong, then it's someone else's problem.
And that said, Paul does double down on the, we'll say brain trauma. So there's a really violent scene and good stunt work when Paul has the shotgun. Mm-hmm. And they're in the woods. They've sort of painted the scene. Is this where they've painted the leaves red?
Yeah, they paint the leaves in this.
So sort of hinting at like what's to come and definitely giving a dynamic red and green scene.
Right.
Now you've got Frankenstein still in all his bandages.
Because, I mean, what's he going to do? Change his clothes, wear a suit? The monster's not going to do that.
No, at this point, he escaped. He sort of broke through his straps. He's thinking freedom at last.
Right.
Come Paul with his shotgun, who shoots him in the eye.
Good shooting.
With a shotgun, no less. So,
it's pretty good.
He should have blown his head off, but I guess it all absorbed in that one eye.
And now, if there wasn't, you know, brain damage before, now we've been shot through the eye with a shotgun.
As if not to leave well enough alone, he brings him back to life again, and almost to show, I did it, because I can.
Right.
And then again shows him to Paul.
So it wasn't killed.
It was. At least life had passed from its body. But don't forget, I was the one who put it there in the first place. It was comparatively easy to destroy it. No, wait, Paul. I want to show you something else.
And he's now taught him tricks in terms of, stand, sit. Does he teach him to speak? I don't remember if he utters any words. I don't think so.
No.
Shall I tell you something, Paul? There you see the result of your handiwork as much as mine. Oh, yes. I gave him life. I put a brain in his head. But I chose a good brain, a brilliant one. It was you who damaged it. You who put a bullet in the wretched thing. This is your fault, Paul. Do you understand that? Your fault.
Yes, I understand.
But you won't win, Paul. And shall I tell you why you won't win? Because I shall carry on. If I can't cure it by brain surgery, then I'll get another brain. And another. And another.
No, no, you will not.
What would you teach Frankenstein to do?
He was so sad. I don't think I could bring myself to tell him to do anything.
Really?
When they return to Frankenstein chained to the wall, for safekeeping at this point.
Right.
He is skittish and afraid.
Maybe he needs a task.
He's so sad looking because now he's had extra surgery on half his head.
Yeah.
And
he's got a 28 days later haircut going on.
But worse, because it's down to the skin. Christopher Lee looks genuinely pathetic. And his body language is that of a dog who's been kicked too many times.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really nervous. And Peter Cushing doesn't fucking hesitate. He never stops being the dominant force.
Right.
And just to reassert that he's in charge, he's yelling at him. And he's rough on Frankenstein's monster. Just no consideration for this terrifying
being. It's taking in a rescued pit bull.
Yeah, and continuing to abuse it.
Mm.
The story is bookended with Peter Cushing in jail. Mm-hmm. Essentially, you assume it's some... town, whatever, facility.
Yeah, he seems to be in a prison.
He's so desperate to be heard and believed at look what I've done.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a little credit, something. But all they know is that he was responsible for a girl's death. So it's a priest is the only audience he can get in prison. And so he's telling the priest this whole story.
Right. And he's through the whole time, though, again, he's being that arrogant, asshole the whole time.
And so frustrated that no one will give him the time of the day.
Yeah, and I love it.
And the priest, he kind of figures that, like, it's your job. Like,
yeah, you have to listen to this.
So it's the story of Frankenstein. So, of course, things end terribly. Mm-hmm. Cut back to Peter Cushing in jail, being held responsible for everything that Frankenstein has done. You know, this girl's death. Paul comes to visit him.
Uh-huh. Paul, my friend. Tell them, Paul.
Tell them what, Victor?
About him. About the creature I made. Go on, Paul, tell them. You were the only person ever to see him apart from myself and Justine.
The girl you murdered.
But I didn't. That's what I've been saying. It was him. He did it.
Who? Who did it, Victor?
The creature I made. You know the man. Tell them.
And at that moment, Frankenstein looks like a crazy person. Like He's invented this whole fucking story, you know, because he's a maniac. And it does lend an element of, like, this could just be the story of a crazy guy inventing a story.
And when you told me that, I thought, like, that's really good.
And it also ends on the same sort of vague idea that he's on his way to the gallows.
Right.
Well, I guess the guillotine.
He's going to get, guillotined right now.
But you don't see it. Roll credits. And it turns out that, like, that turned out to be the most poignant sort of perfect open-ended story because, of course, they're going to have to return to this story.
Of course.
Except it turns out the screenwriter hadn't planned on it.
No, he hadn't. If you ever get the chance to watch A History of Horror that was on the BBC and it's on, like, YouTube, there's sections.
Cool.
The second section is about essentially, like, English horror. Hmm. And there's an interview with the writer who's Jimmy Sangster. He meant for the first one to be done, and he meant for Frankenstein to be killed and done. But the producer a few years later came to him and said, I sold another Frankenstein movie. So we're going to do that in 10 weeks.
It's like Ed Wood. We've already got the posters.
Exactly. It's exactly like that. And Jimmy says, but you never asked me to write this film. And the producer said, I'm asking you right now. And Jimmy says, no, I don't want to write it. And he says, no, you're going to write it because I already sold it. We're already getting money for this. It's like got to be done.
The brain candy exchange is like, so where are we on that? It's like that project you just mentioned just now.
Oh, I'm on it.
Yeah.
I'm right on that. So he says, I don't want to write it, but I will write it if you let me direct. So that was probably a bad idea. And even Jimmy Sangster will tell you that. Well, he won't tell you anything, but in the documentary, he would even say that that was a bad idea. So you got 1970s, The Horror of Frankenstein, which is a really, really bad, bad movie. Mm, bad by all accounts.
Wrote and directed.
Yes. Mm. He was the writer-director.
Did you say 1970?
That was in 1970. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so with Terrence Fisher, they did make a couple more. They sort of solidified the franchise before they gave this guy a shot.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
And this was, time in between. And he said, that's why he didn't want to do another one. Mm-hmm. And so he was able to play his cards. It didn't work out well. He also did Lust for a Vampire, which is the same in 1970. And again, is another atrocious film.
A lot of blood, a lot of sex.
Yeah. Yes. Lots of blood, lots of sex. That was in 1970 was the beginning of a real change in horror, in Hammer horror film, where it became more about the sex than even the horror.
Saturation point.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not exactly like it's Jimmy's fault. But that was in 1970. Hammer was really kind of losing the market there.
Yeah. It speaks to the idea of a guy who, like, this is your one job. This is your one story. Tell the shit out of it. Like, really do your best. And the movie functioned well on that level. Like, I really dug. I said I could watch Peter Cushing read the phone book. Mm-hmm. It's funny. The idea of a phone book is not a thing anymore.
Right. Sometimes
read pages from the internet.
Sometimes there's a phone book downstairs in the lobby. Someone delivers
open.
It. Yeah. I don't know what happens with it.
Someone's delivering that goddamn
thing.
Yeah.
And I think, like, is this for me? I don't know what to do with a phone book.
Verizon, lower our phone bill and stop making goddamn phone
books. Exactly, because they seem expensive.
A year later, in 1958, The Horror of Dracula came out. Shortly after the credits, you've got blood dripping on Dracula's tomb. So just to give you a sense of like what to expect, it's aptly named. It is the horror of Dracula.
It's going
to
be a fire engine red blood.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Romero, like from Dawn of the Dead,
yeah,
house paint red.
It's thick and it's bright red orange.
Dracula's a messy eater.
Yeah, that's right. Sloppy slops.
So, in keeping with the theme of the sort of pressure from Universal that they could not tell the traditional story, So the book first adapted to theater and the theater piece adapted to the film with Lugosi, they had to do something else entirely.
Right.
I really like the subterfuge with Jonathan Harker showing up as he traditionally did to Dracula's castle, but now he's got an agenda. And we find this out. He has a really awkward encounter with one of the brides of Dracula who begs to be saved.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you come in. My name's Jonathan Harker. I'm the new librarian.
You will help me, won't you? Say you will. Please.
How can I help you?
Get me away from here.
But why?
He's keeping me prisoner.
Who is? Count Dracula? I'm afraid I don't understand.
Oh, please. Please help me to escape.
Right, right. And I thought to myself, Harker should probably care a little bit more.
Right.
Because I didn't know, like, he's
on a mission.
Exactly, exactly. So when that reveal finally comes out that he knows what Dracula is, he meant to go there all along, I was like, that's so cool.
It was a great turn on the character and the story. Sadly, it
doesn't work out,
play out
well
in his favor.
Yeah, no, not so good.
They have completely removed the character of Renfield.
Right, which so I that love initial, that character. You know how much I loved that. And even in all the Dracula things, I love the idea that Dracula has his bug eaters. He has his harbingers. And I really like that about Dracula because, like, Dracula rolls, like, fucking deep. You know what I'm saying? And I liked that. So, but now Dracula's kind of like a solitary fella. He keeps a lady around, maybe.
Yeah, and he's not... I think Christopher Lee... You know, he's got, I think someone might have counted, he's got maybe 16 lines in the entire film.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas Lugosi clearly liked to hear himself talk.
Right.
Christopher Lee is satisfied to just be 6'4", towering over scenes and just be physically intimidating.
Right, right.
Yeah. So when Harker goes missing, Peter Cushing is not far behind. Peter Cushing is playing Van Helsing, the role he will come back and do time and time again. And he's an even bigger badass.
Yeah.
He's a badass plus being a doctor in a number of different things.
Right.
It's one of my favorite repeating gags, and they bring it back in The Brides of Dracula. But later in the movie, there's a point where he's trying to get information from a guy whose job it is to, like, ship, in this case, coffins from original lands. And Van Helsing tells him he's a doctor and shows him a business card.
Right, right.
At, like, that's all the credibility you needed. You needed to say you were a doctor and present a business card. And at this point, like, $20 at Vistaprint, you must surely be a doctor. Who
exactly
else would spend that money?
I mean,
on
there
it?
Wouldn't be a business card if you weren't. Thanks for this business card. But he doesn't even give the business card. He just shows the business card.
Him. Yeah.
They're like, oh, you can't have this.
Jonathan Harker only makes it as far as taking out one of the brides, and incidentally, the woman who was asking for his help.
Exactly. So in a way, he did help her. He saved her immortal soul.
And apparently she was way older than she let on, because once he... Okay, firstly...
Also, she's the maid from Frankenstein, and I think she's wearing the same dress, BTW, because she's wearing a white dress with boobs out.
Yeah.
I mean, so I'm just, you know, whatever. They probably, like, filmed one and then were like, can we do these scenes while you're here on the set, please?
He encounters her in the same room, in the same tomb area, conveniently just slightly off
the side
of the front door.
And it seems to be, like, labeled Dracula.
It might as well be.
Yeah,
because like
when the blood
vampire,
is all on it, it's like, whoa, well, this is clearly Dracula's.
He gets in there. There's Christopher Lee asleep.
Mm-hmm.
There she is asleep. He opts for her first. Like,
and
what is he warming up?
He looks too. He does like a maybe, and then he says, no, this is the best option for no reason. Why would you just take it? Because I told you though, because this would be the shortest like freaking movie ever.
Oh, Harker Dracula
kills
dies
Dracula
in the first 5 minutes.
End.
So as if to keep this story long,
yes,
kills her first, and she very coolly transitions to an old woman,
yes,
which I guess
is good, great.
Everybody he kills, everybody who dies by the stake, conspicuously low. By then, they knew where Hart was, but for some reason, everyone gets stabbed in the sternum.
Yeah, well, I thought because they really like to show it for some reason, I thought it was to like avoid the boob area.
Yeah.
So I think that's like why he did that. My problem with the death and the stabbing wasn't the location. It was the terrible like acting that went on with like
of the victim. Like,
yeah, it was very like Paul Rubens in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. You know, just like keeps happening. And you just keep like, that's how I felt.
And it's loud enough that like, obviously, Dracula's gonna wake up.
Well,
and that's
no,
why
I mean,
you,
it's daytime.
He,
it's
him.
Not that he's like asleep and not being disturbed. He wakes up because the sun's going down, not because she's screaming.
Oh, was that?
You could play cymbals next to Dracula during the daytime, Darren, and he won't wake up.
I think it depends on which lore you're going
well,
by.
But this one, seemingly, I mean, I think he's just sitting there.
All right. I didn't realize that the sun was going down.
Yeah, and then he
but
it shows
by the time
this
he
terrible
gets to
window
Dracula's
transition.
Sleeping place, he's gone.
He
course.
Takes a very long time with her. That's what you don't understand. It's like a time lapse. He spent about 30 minutes killing her.
Admiring his own work.
And why doesn't he get up first thing in the morning and fucking do this? Why'd you wait till evening time, stupid?
That's a very good, important point.
Yeah.
His timing is awful.
Also, though, I mean, there's a lot because it's not that I dislike these movies. It's just there's a little, just a lot of problems with
oh,
them.
Well,
and
that's a plot hole. Absolutely.
Why? So, yeah, perfect. Get a, you know, do this first thing a.m., then go home. The end.
Get
I don't
home
understand.
By supper.
Exactly. I don't understand this. But also, how does Jonathan know about this? Like, why is he there?
Oh, well, Van Helsing and him were working together. Like, Van Helsing, he knows.
So
the
Van
ins
Helsing
and outs.
Sent him in knowing he's like an incompetent worker.
Yeah, I guess that's
like sorry.
So cut to Van Helsing and his, you know, sort of discovering that Jonathan Harker has been turned.
Right.
And that sort of turn checking the neck, it seems like half of Van Helsing's like doctoring is just checking people's neck in this
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, and but I did like that at least in Victorian times the ladies all seem to have a really high neck, so
yeah.
You're like, ooh, that's hidden right there. Also, though, I wasn't impressed that greatly with the makeup, which it's again Phil Leakey on makeup who did Frankenstein and other Hammer
okay.
films. And it just kind of looked like he had this, like, really bad acne to, like, really gross, disgusting.
I think Jonathan Harker's bloody neck, we see him sort of, his bloody neck is the first time we ever see that in a Dracula movie. Because Lugosi, all that
right.
stuff, even the teeth were not present on screen. But I thought really cool sort of trivia is that the Spanish movie in 31 that they
right.
were making concurrently with Lugosi's, they did go as far as showing the bite marks on the neck. And from what I understand, that movie is also kind of sexier than
right,
Lugosi's.
It is. Yeah.
Have you seen it?
I've seen clips of it.
Okay.
When we did the Universal one, I looked up clips of it.
Okay.
I think it's interesting that it's just then people assumed, like in the Universal one, since it wasn't shown, you just know, people know that Dracula bites you on the neck and this is what it looks like. And
yeah.
I don't know, there's something to that because here then you have these like kind of gross, disgusting, infected looking wounds on the neck
risen
here.
Risen too, everything
yeah,
swells.
Yeah, it's really gross.
Dracula's like a mosquito.
Exactly. That's not sexy. Not sexy at all.
So down the line, when Van Helsing eventually encounters Lucy, it's one of my favorite special effects in the movie, but Van Helsing is not hesitant to pull out his like big iron crucifix.
He loves putting the cross on people.
Oh, and does he? That shit sizzles when it hits
yeah.
her head and she is, you know, horrified. And then when he pulls it away and you see her burnt
yeah.
head, like that was the horror of Dracula.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool.
That was really good. And it, you know, later is then used in a lot of movies, but I think of always Fright Night
yeah.
when evil gets zonked on the head with the cross.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I'll call that.
Yeah. So Van Helsing coming back to sort of tell everybody of the bad news that Jonathan Harker's dead and, you know, his family should sort of get used to that. Tell
right.
tell his bride. This whole time, Mina has been.
Well, no.
Bedridden.
See, here's the thing is this is where it varies from Universal. He's now Jonathan's
a
now
Lucy.
With Lucy and Mina's with this brother of Lucy.
Who's played by Michael Go. Okay. People probably know him as Alfred from the 1989
exactly.
Batman and Batman Returns.
He's very good. And this Alan has a lot of information about Dracula.
I always understood that if there were such things, they could change themselves into bats or wolves. That's a common fallacy. Homewood, the study of these creatures has been my life's work. I've carried out research with some of the greatest authorities in Europe, and yet we've only just scratched the surface. You see, a great deal is known about the vampire bat, but details of these reanimated bodies of the dead, the undead, as we call them, are so obscure that many biologists will not believe they exist.
He has to be like the dude in charge and be like, actually, the myths you think are true about vampires, not so much, because we'll get sued. He's kind of obsessed with whatever his own knowledge he dictates. And that mm-hmm. is really cool that he's got a very early like Edison recording device.
Yes.
Memo, check final arrangements with Harker before he leaves for Klausenburg. 3. The crucifix, symbolizing the power of good over evil. The power of the crucifix in these cases is twofold. It protects the normal human being, but reveals the vampire or victim of this vile contagion when in advanced stages.
But that's something, too, throughout these movies, and I don't know. I mean, I'm not obviously a person who would speak for all ladies or whatever, but when I say, like, I don't think these movies were made for me particularly, all the men seem to know what the fuck is going on. Mm. Do you notice that every single man knows what's going on? And the ladies are just kind of like, I don't know.
Yeah, and their maid is sort of like the fall guy. She's the
Gerda.
Scapegoat.
And she's
plot
the
device.
Worst. She needs to get out. I actually wrote in my notes, I have congruent notes that look really nice and stuff. And then all of a sudden I wrote, God damn it, Gerda. I think it was about the time she lost that coffin.
You had one job to do.
He's like, keep the doors closed, bitch.
Because, wait, at this point, is it Mina or Lucy?
Oh, it's Lucy, I think, because that's when Lucy becomes finally a vampire.
Okay. Upon her request, Gerda gets rid of the garlic flowers
right.
and opens the window.
Come on in, Dracula, yeah. says Gerda.
Gerda, what happened?
You said I must come back to Adam's. I came up here and he looked like the devil.
Now, what happened?
He came in here and he picked Madame up like she was a baby.
But it does, at least, this is one thing I did like, that it kept very similar to the story, that Lucy, even though she's Mina and it's confusing in this, Lucy still remains the, once she becomes a vampire, she's preying on children. And I think she's like Lucy is one of the best characters in vampire stories because she's going to take easy pickings.
And this time,
and I love it.
In the Lugosi one, they just sort of explain that all this happened off camera.
Well, she's like wandering around, like, yeah, picking up kids and stuff.
Right. But here we get to see her, like, I've got a friend I want you to meet. Like,
yeah,
that,
come over here.
Fucking creepy.
Yeah, get in my van. And you're like, okay.
There's candy in there.
So I like that they kept that because I think, like, you know, that is something that is gruesome and horrible. And at least, like, it's not a good thing, but it's like a strong lady finally. Well, even though she's picking, I guess, on Leek. I guess it doesn't edit that out.
So jumping ahead, Dracula has Mina. He's turned her. There, it seems like there's some wiggle room in
there's
terms
wiggle room
of
right now with
how
her.
Long
Lucy
it'll take.
Is like goner.
Yeah.
But Mina is kind of like,
yeah. So Michael Gow, go.
We say go in my house. That's what my dad says, but I don't know.
Okay. So Michael Gow and Van Helsing. It's funny. I'm using the actor and the character.
Arthur is Michael Gow.
They chase down Dracula. They're back at his castle. This is the showdown. Van Helsing and Dracula have a great sort of knockdown drag out. His crucifix gets thrown away,
right.
but he quickly improvises
yeah.
with iron candlesticks.
Because everything works. Anything works.
So this may be the first time we've seen someone just improvise a crucifix.
Yeah, like I didn't know that would work. Maybe you should have let everyone know.
Right, and why does it work? What the fuck does Dracula have against perpendicular lines?
He hates them.
But at that point, like, if that's the case,
everything in Dracula's house should be round. Like, there
maybe
should be no right
like
angles.
Maybe it's like a feng shui kind of thing. I don't know.
Dracula hates.
Yeah, like, how does he live under his crossbeams?
Every window, every, yeah.
Yeah, there's... he stands in front of windows all the time.
So, all that said, Van Helsing sort of fends him off, gets him in direct sunlight, and there's some pretty good, like,
it
Christopher
good.
Lee to Ash...
Yeah.
Dying scene stuff.
Except for I hated the part where, I mean, it looked cool when his hands are becoming ash, mm-hmm. but he's still like kind of holding himself up by his hands, even though they've turned to ash. So it's like, is it the bones or what? I don't know what's happening here.
Yeah, it was 1958. Beggars can't be choosers.
I shall be a chooser.
So in the tradition of all these monster movies, Dracula has been beaten. Roll credits.
Right.
Until the next time.
Right.
All right. We're going to take a break here because this is becoming an epic show.
There's a lot to talk about.
There is. And I'm excited about all of it. I'm pretty thrilled with the series. But we will be back next week with the second part of The Monsters of Hammer. So stay tuned. Find us on social media. We're at The Rance Macabre on Facebook and Twitter. And give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you found us.
You can also check out our website at therancemacabre.com, where we have additional content.
Videos and the like. Great. So we will see you next week.
You've been listening to The Rance Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network. Produced by Tom DeFeo, executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rance Macabre, you can contact Ken at fangoria.com.